A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what air quality is actually like in China. Is it a countrywide problem or mostly concentrated in the big cities? What's the average AQI? And the big question, is it actually improving? There's a lot to unpack here, and honestly, the answer has changed dramatically in the last decade.
It really has. I was digging into the latest IQAir World Air Quality Report, and China's trajectory is one of the most striking environmental stories of the past 15 years. The numbers are genuinely remarkable. In 2013, Beijing's annual average PM25 concentration was around 90 micrograms per cubic meter. For context, the WHO guideline is 5. By 2025, that number had dropped to around 32. That's a 65% reduction.
The infamous airpocalypse. That actually happened.
January 2013 was the wake-up call. Beijing hit PM2.5 levels above 800 micrograms per cubic meter. The U.S. Embassy's air quality monitor literally maxed out. It wasn't calibrated for readings that high. People called it the airpocalypse, and it went viral on Chinese social media. The government couldn't ignore it.
That's interesting, because usually the phrase went viral on Chinese social media is followed by, and then it was deleted.
Right, but this was different. This was a physical reality people could see and feel and smell. You can't censor what's in your lungs. And to the government's credit, and I think we should give credit where it's due, they responded with what became known as the War on Pollution. In 2013, the State Council released the Air Pollution Prevention and Control Action Plan. They set specific binding targets for PM2. Beijing, Tianjin, and Hebei Province had to cut concentrations by 25% by 2017, the Yangtze River Delta by 20%, the Pearl River Delta by 15%.
They actually hit those?
They exceeded them. Beijing, Tianjin, Hebei cut PM25 by about 40% by 2017. The Pearl River Delta hit the WHO's interim target years ahead of schedule. It was one of the fastest air quality improvements ever documented at a national scale. The University of Chicago's Air Quality Life Index, the AQLI, estimates that if the reductions from 2013 to 2020 are sustained, the average Chinese citizen will live about 2 years longer.
2 years of life expectancy? That's not a rounding error.
It's enormous. To put that in perspective, the AQLI calculates that particulate pollution is the single greatest external threat to human health globally, shaving more years off life expectancy than smoking, than alcohol, than unsafe water. And China's improvement since 2013 has added back more life years than any other country's pollution reduction effort in modern history.
The narrative of China's air is an unmitigated disaster. That's outdated.
It's about a decade out of date. But here's where it gets nuanced, and this connects directly to the question about whether it's countrywide or city-specific. The improvements have been dramatic, but they've also been uneven, geographically and seasonally. The biggest gains have been in the major urban centers. Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, Shenzhen. These cities had the worst pollution. They had the most political pressure to clean up, and they had the resources to do it. They shut down or relocated heavy industry, converted coal heating to natural gas, implemented strict vehicle emission standards, and built out enormous air quality monitoring networks.
The rural areas.
That's where it gets complicated. Rural China still relies heavily on coal and biomass for heating and cooking. The monitoring network is thinner. You have fewer stations, less data. AQICN and IQAir rely on official monitoring stations plus some low-cost sensors, but coverage outside major cities is spottier. We know less about what people are actually breathing in the countryside.
The data itself has an urban bias.
China's national monitoring network has over 2,000 stations now, which sounds like a lot until you realize the country has over 600 cities and hundreds of millions of people living in towns and villages. and the stations tend to cluster where the political and economic stakes are highest. A study from a few years back found that monitor placement in some areas was, let's say, strategically optimized to avoid the worst pollution hotspots.
Strategically optimized. That's a very diplomatic way of saying they put the monitors where the air is cleaner.
I'm a retired pediatrician, not a diplomat. But yes, there's evidence that some monitors were cited to produce more favorable readings. Parks, government compounds, upwind of industrial zones. The Chinese government has cracked down on this. There were high-profile cases of officials tampering with monitors, spraying water on sensors, that kind of thing. But the structural incentive to place monitors in cleaner locations is harder to police.
The national average AQI might be rosier than reality.
But even with that caveat, the trend is real and it's significant. Let me give you some concrete numbers. In 2024, China's national average PM2.5 concentration was about 29 micrograms per cubic meter, according to the IQ Air report. That's down from roughly 72 in 2013. It's still almost 6 times the WHO guideline of 5, but it's a massive improvement. The average AQI across major cities hovers somewhere in the moderate range, call it 80 to 100 for much of the year, with seasonal spikes.
Let's talk about those spikes. Because when I look at the real-time maps, you still see Chinese cities in the red and purple zones regularly.
Winter heating season. November through March, especially in the north. The centralized heating systems in cities like Harbin, Shenyang, Shijiazhuang, these were historically coal-fired, and the conversion to natural gas has been incomplete. Plus, temperature inversions trap pollution near the ground. You get these multi-day episodes where PM25 concentrations jump to 200, 300 micrograms per cubic meter. In January 2024, several northern cities recorded daily averages above 300.
If you're in Harbin in January, it's still bad.
It's still bad. Better than 2013, but bad. And this is where the countrywide versus big cities question gets an interesting answer. The worst air in China today is not in Beijing or Shanghai. It's in the industrial and mining cities that most Westerners have never heard of. Linfen in Shaanxi province was historically one of the most polluted cities on earth. It sits in a valley surrounded by coal mines and steel mills. Yangquan, also in Shaanxi. Anyang in Henan. Tangshan in Hebei, that's actually a city of over 7 million people, but it's not on the international radar the way Beijing is.
The obscure cities.
And this connects to something fascinating. The visibility of pollution shapes the political response. Beijing's air got cleaned up in part because Beijing is where the leadership lives, where foreign embassies are, where journalists are. The political cost of bad air in the capital was enormous. A city like Linfen doesn't have that leverage. The improvement there has been real but slower, and the baseline was worse.
We've got a three-tier system. Tier 1, the superstar cities that cleaned up dramatically. Tier 2, the industrial mid-sized cities that improved but still have serious problems. Tier 3, the rural areas where we don't even have good data.
That's a fair taxonomy, and I'd add a seasonal dimension. Even the superstar cities have bad days and bad weeks. Beijing's air in summer 2025 was good. Blue skies, PM2.5 in the teens, comparable to a decent day in Los Angeles. But in winter, when the heating kicks on and the air stagnates, you can still get readings above 150.
The blue skies during the 2008 Olympics, was that the canary in the coal mine, metaphorically speaking? The proof that if you shut everything down, the air cleans up, and it will let it rip, it doesn't?
That was the preview. The Olympic blue phenomenon, they shut down factories, restricted driving, and the sky turned blue. It demonstrated that the pollution was anthropogenic and controllable. But 2008 was a temporary shutdown. The permanent shift came after 2013. What's interesting is that the improvement has continued even as the economy grew. From 2013 to 20, China's GDP grew by about 70% and PM2.5 fell by about 40%. That decoupling of economic growth from pollution is the holy grail of environmental policy.
How did they actually do it? Beyond war on pollution as a slogan.
A few big levers. 1. They shut down small, inefficient coal-fired boilers, millions of them, and replaced them with centralized gas heating or electric. 2. They enforced much stricter emission standards on power plants and steel mills, and they actually enforced them. 3. They restricted vehicle ownership and usage in major cities. Beijing has a license plate lottery, and on high pollution days, they implement odd even driving restrictions. 4. They invested massively in renewable energy. China now has more solar and wind capacity than any other country by a huge margin.
The electric vehicle piece is significant too, right?
China is the world's largest EV market by far. In 2025, over 50% of new car sales in China were electric or plug-in hybrid. That's staggering. In Norway, it's higher, but Norway is a country of 5 million people. China is doing this at continental scale. Every electric bus, every electric taxi, every electric scooter replaces a tailpipe that would otherwise be spewing particulates at street level where people breathe.
Those electric buses. Shenzhen converted its entire fleet, right?
16,000 buses, all electric, by 2018. The first major city in the world to do it. Now dozens of Chinese cities have followed. The air quality impact of switching from diesel buses to electric is immediate and local. You're removing a major source of black carbon and nitrogen oxides from dense urban corridors.
The picture is improving, unevenly, with seasonal caveats. But what's the average AQI? The prompt asked for a number.
It's hard to give a single number that's meaningful for a country of 1.4 billion people across 9.6 million square kilometers. But if you want a ballpark, the national average PM2.5 concentration in 2024 was around 29 micrograms per cubic meter. On the US AQI scale, that translates to an index value of roughly 85 to 90. That's the upper end of moderate. For comparison, the US national average is around 8 micrograms per cubic meter, which is an AQI in the 30s or 40s. India's national average is over 50 micrograms per cubic meter.
China sits in the middle. Not as clean as the West, not as polluted as South Asia.
That's the broad picture. But again, the variation is enormous. On a given day in May, you might see Shanghai at an AQI of 45, Beijing at 60, and Shijiazhuang at 120. In January, those numbers might be 80, 150, and 250.
Do we trust the official Chinese AQI numbers?
More than we used to. The US Embassy in Beijing stopped publishing its own PM25 data in 2022. They handed that function over to a contractor, and it's no longer the independent check it once was. But the proliferation of low-cost sensors, the IQ Air network, the fact that Chinese citizens now expect real-time air quality data, all of that makes systematic manipulation harder. I think the official numbers are directionally accurate, even if individual stations might be cited favorably.
What about ozone? We've been talking about PM2.5, but ozone is the other big one.
Ozone is a growing problem in China, and it's one where the trends are less encouraging. Ground-level ozone forms when nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds react in sunlight. 5 has declined. Ozone has actually increased in many Chinese cities. There's a complex chemical relationship where particulate matter can actually suppress ozone formation by blocking sunlight. Clean up the particulates, and suddenly you've got more ozone. It's been called the ozone penalty of PM2.
That's darkly ironic. You solve one problem and create another.
It's the whack-a-mole nature of air quality management. Ozone is a powerful respiratory irritant. It triggers asthma attacks, reduces lung function, and it's been linked to cardiovascular problems. In the summer of 2024, ozone exceeded the national standard in over 30% of monitoring stations across the Beijing-Tianjin-Hebei region. It's becoming the dominant pollutant in the warmer months.
If someone is moving to China and asking, what's the air like? The answer is, it depends on where and when.
What you're sensitive to. If you have asthma, ozone is going to matter more than PM2.5 in summer. If you're in Harbin in winter, PM2.5 is the concern. If you're in Shenzhen, the air is probably fine year-round. The Pearl River Delta has done remarkably well. Shenzhen's annual PM25 average is under 20, which is comparable to many European cities.
Shenzhen is basically the poster child for what's possible.
It really is. A fishing village 40 years ago, now a megacity of over 17 million people, and its air is cleaner than Los Angeles on an average day. That's an extraordinary achievement. It's also a reminder that air pollution is a policy choice. Shenzhen chose to go electric early, chose to relocate heavy industry, chose to invest in public transit. The air didn't get clean by accident.
Let's talk about the health impact. You were a pediatrician. What does this mean at ground level?
The health burden of air pollution in China is still enormous, even with the improvements. A study in The Lancet a few years back estimated that air pollution contributes to over 1 million premature deaths annually in China. That number has come down as PM2.5 has declined, but it's still staggering. For children, the effects include reduced lung development, higher rates of asthma, increased respiratory infections. There's also emerging evidence linking prenatal PM2.5 exposure to low birth weight and developmental issues.
You practiced in Jerusalem. Did you see patients affected by this kind of thing?
Different air quality challenges in Israel, but the mechanisms are the same. Particulate matter below 2.5 microns, that's about 1/30th. The width of a human hair penetrates deep into the lungs, crosses into the bloodstream, and causes systemic inflammation. The body treats it as an invader, and that chronic inflammatory response damages blood vessels, the heart, the lungs, the brain. It's slow-motion damage.
In China, hundreds of millions of people have been breathing this for decades.
Which is why the improvement since 2013 is so significant. If the AQLI calculation is right, 2 years of life expectancy gained, we're talking about hundreds of millions of life years added across the population. That's one of the greatest public health victories in history, and it's barely discussed in the West.
Why do you think that is?
Partly because the narrative of China is polluted is sticky, and it fits a certain geopolitical framing. Partly because environmental progress doesn't make headlines the way environmental disasters do. The airpocalypse was news. The slow, steady cleanup is not. And partly because there's a lingering distrust of Chinese environmental data, some of it warranted.
It's also just hard to visualize improvement. A blue sky doesn't look like news. A gray sky does.
The absence of pollution is invisible. You need before and after data to see the trend, and most people aren't looking at PM2.5 time series.
Let's dig into the regional variation more. You mentioned the north-south divide, heating season in the north, but there's also a west-east divide, right?
Western China, Xinjiang, Gansu, parts of Inner Mongolia, has a different pollution profile. You've got dust storms from the Gobi and Taklamakan deserts that produce massive PM10 spikes. That's natural source particulate matter, not industrial. But the distinction between natural and dangerous doesn't matter to your lungs. A dust particle is still a dust particle. In the spring, cities like Lanzhou and Urumqi can see AQI readings in the hazardous range from dust alone.
The monitoring network out there.
Xinjiang is enormous. It's about the size of Iran and has a handful of monitoring stations concentrated in Urumqi and a few other cities. The Taklamakan Desert itself is an air quality data void. We know dust storms are frequent and intense, but we don't have granular ground-level data.
The answer to is, it's countrywide or mostly in big cities, is, it's countrywide, but the flavor of pollution changes.
That's well put. In the northern industrial cities, it's coal combustion and heavy industry in winter. In the eastern megacities, it's vehicle emissions and secondary aerosol formation year-round, with winter coal heating layered on. In the west, it's dust. In the south, it's generally better because of the climate. More rain, more atmospheric mixing. But the Pearl River Delta has its own industrial emissions profile.
What about indoor air quality? That's the other half of the equation.
Critically important and often overlooked. In rural China, indoor air pollution from solid fuel cooking and heating, coal, wood, crop residues, is a major health risk, especially for women and children who spend more time indoors. The Chinese government has pushed rural coal to electricity and coal-to-gas conversion programs, but they've been unevenly implemented. There were reports a few winters back of villagers in northern China freezing because the gas infrastructure wasn't ready when the coal was taken away.
The transition has costs.
And that's the tension at the heart of energy transition everywhere, the trade-off between immediate human needs and long-term environmental goals. China has navigated it with a heavy hand, which allows for rapid change, but also produces these kinds of implementation failures.
For someone living in a major Chinese city today, what does the day-to-day experience of air quality actually look like?
It looks like checking an app. Just like people in Los Angeles or London check the weather, people in Beijing check the AQI. If it's a green or yellow day, AQI under 100, life is normal. If it's orange, 100 to 150, sensitive people might wear a mask outdoors. If it's red or purple, above 150, schools might cancel outdoor activities, people run air purifiers indoors, and mask wearing becomes widespread.
The mask culture that emerged during COVID must have felt somewhat familiar.
In China, masking for pollution predated COVID by years. The transition to masking for disease prevention was seamless because the hardware and the habit were already there. In fact, one of the interesting side effects of China's pollution cleanup is that mask wearing for pollution has declined in cities like Beijing and Shanghai, simply because there are fewer bad air days.
We've covered the trend, the regional variation, the health impacts, the monitoring challenges. What about the future trajectory? Is the improvement going to continue?
That's the big question. The low-hanging fruit has been picked. Shutting down the dirtiest coal boilers, enforcing basic emission standards on power plants, those were relatively straightforward, if politically difficult. The next phase of improvement requires tackling harder problems. Agriculture, ammonia emissions from fertilizer and livestock are a major precursor to secondary particulate formation. Transportation. While EVs are booming, the total vehicle fleet is still growing, and the remaining coal infrastructure, China still burns more coal than the rest of the world combined, even as it builds renewables faster than anyone.
The coal piece seems like the elephant in the room.
China's coal consumption has plateaued but not declined significantly. They're still building new coal-fired power plants, even as utilization rates at existing plants have fallen. The argument is energy security. You need baseload power, and you can't rely entirely on renewables until storage catches up. But every new coal plant locks in emissions for decades.
Air quality is a co-benefit of climate policy here, right? The same things that reduce carbon emissions also reduce particulates.
The overlap is almost perfect. Phasing out coal is good for the climate and good for lungs. Electrifying transport is good for the climate and good for lungs. The synergies are so strong that some analysts argue air quality improvement, not climate mitigation, is the real driver of China's energy transition. The Communist Party cares about visible, tangible benefits that keep the population content. Blue skies deliver that. Abstract climate targets, less so.
The cynical read is that China is cleaning up its air because it has to, not because it wants to save the planet.
It's not even cynical, it's just accurate. The domestic political imperative is the engine. The international climate commitments are the tailwind. But the outcome is the same, less coal, more renewables, cleaner air.
Let's circle back to the average AQI question, because I want to make sure we nail this. If someone asks, what's the AQI in China? What's the one-sentence answer?
The national average PM2.5-based AQI hovers around 85 to 95, the upper end of moderate on the U.S. scale. But that single number conceals enormous variation from city to city, season to season, and year to year, with the long-term trend pointing firmly downward.
That's the kind of answer that makes people angry because they wanted a simple number.
Air quality is not simple. Anyone who gives you a simple number for a country of 1.4 billion people is misleading you. The honest answer is, it depends, and here's what it depends on.
What about the comparison to other countries? If someone's benchmark is, say, Los Angeles or London?
The cleanest Chinese cities, Shenzhen, Kunming, Xiamen, Haiku, have air quality comparable to or better than Los Angeles on an average day. The most polluted Chinese cities, the industrial centers in Shaanxi and Hebei, have air quality comparable to Delhi on a bad day, and significantly worse than any major Western city on an average day. The range is that wide.
Beijing sits where?
Beijing's annual PM2.5 average is around 30 to 35 micrograms per cubic meter now. That's roughly comparable to Milan or Krakow, European cities with known air quality challenges. It's worse than London or Paris, better than Delhi or Dhaka. It's in the middle of the global pack for major cities.
That's a sentence that would have been unthinkable in 2013.
Beijing going from airpocalypse to roughly comparable to Milan in a decade is an extraordinary achievement. It's not mission accomplished. Milan's air isn't something to aspire to, but the velocity of improvement is remarkable.
What role did public pressure play in this? You mentioned the 2013 viral moment, but was there sustained civil society pressure?
Limited, because the space for independent environmental activism in China is constrained. What you had instead was a combination of elite concern, The leadership breathes Beijing's air too, and a kind of ambient public discontent that registered through social media, through complaints to local governments, through the implicit understanding that air pollution was a legitimacy problem for the party. The Chinese government's legitimacy rests significantly on its ability to deliver tangible improvements in quality of life. Bad air undermines that.
It's not activism in the Western sense, but it's a form of accountability.
A very different form, but real. The citizen complaints through official channels, the ambient grumbling on Weibo, the fact that the children of the elite attend schools in Beijing, these things create pressure. And the government responded with a massive, technocratic, top-down campaign that worked.
Last question from me before we wrap. If someone is traveling to China and wants to protect their health, what should they do?
Check the AQI for your destination in advance and check it daily while you're there. Bring N95 or KN95 masks, the same ones you'd use for COVID work for particulates. If you're staying long-term, invest in a good air purifier for your apartment. The Xiaomi and Philips units are popular and effective. If you're going to an industrial city in the north in winter, expect bad air and plan accordingly. If you're going to Shenzhen or Kunming in summer, you probably don't need to worry at all. And download the IQ Air or AQICN app. Real-time data is your friend.
The same common sense precautions you'd take anywhere with variable air quality.
China is not a monolith. The air in Harbin in January is not the air in Sanya in July. Treat it like weather. Check the forecast. Dress accordingly.
The mask is the umbrella of air quality.
The umbrella of air quality. I'm going to use that.
It's yours. Free of charge.
Generous as always.
One thing I keep thinking about. We've talked about PM2.5, ozone, the trends, but there's something almost philosophical about air quality as a metric. It's the ultimate shared resource. You can opt out of the air you breathe. A rich person and a poor person in the same city breathe the same particulates.
There's some nuance there. Wealthier people can afford air purifiers. They can live in neighborhoods upwind of industrial zones. They can send their kids to schools with filtered air. There's an environmental justice dimension to air pollution everywhere, including China. But you're right that it's more egalitarian than, say, access to healthcare or education. The ambient air is the ambient air.
That's why it's such a politically potent issue. Everyone has skin in the game, or lungs in the game, I suppose.
Lungs in the game. You're on a roll with the metaphors today.
I've been practicing. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1860s, a phantom island called Sandwich Island appeared on nautical charts off the coast of the Namib Desert with an estimated population of zero. It never existed, but cartographers kept copying it from earlier maps for over 40 years before anyone bothered to sail there and check.
Imagine copying someone's homework for 4 decades and never once asking if the answer was made up.
The entire discipline of cartography, just coasting on vibes. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. Find show notes, transcripts, and more at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn. I'm Herman Poppleberry. See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.